You're listening to KTOO News Juno. The following is a broadcast of Mudrooms, Juno's live storytelling event. Mudrooms is currently in its third season, and thanks to the Juno community, it is going strong. The event is the recipient of the Mayor's Award for the Arts this year for innovation. My name is Amanda Compton. On behalf of the Mudrooms organizers, Alita Buss, Tom Cosgrove, Mark Wheeler, Rich Moniak, Katie Spielberger, Pat Roach, and Clint Farr, I'd like to thank listeners like you for your support and just being who you are. The seven personal stories you are about to hear were told on January 14th, 2014, at the Northern Light United Church. The theme for the evening was Grace. Music was performed by Liz Saya and friends.
Our first speaker is Erin Hansen, Mudrooms alum. While Erin was born and raised in Southeast Alaska, she has a soft spot for the Midwest. Between going to college in Belleville, Wisconsin, and spending holidays with her grandparents in Northfield, Minnesota, she considers herself an honorary Midwesterner. Her parental grandparents are both Swedish-American and were featured in the Mudrooms story told by her father, Bill Hansen, during the November Mudrooms event. Here's Erin.
So after my partner Andrew and I had been together for about 2 years, I finally had the chance to bring him home to meet my grandparents. And I never brought anybody home to meet my grandparents before. So I knew I needed to do a little bit of prep on both sides. Andrew had never actually been to the Midwest before. And my grandparents live in like this concentrated version of the Midwest, which is a retirement home in Northfield, Minnesota. And they are the only Swedes in a retirement home full of Norwegians. Which in Minnesota terms means that like 200 years ago, everybody's ancestors immigrated from those countries, but you still refer to yourself as Swedish and Norwegian. And my grandparents had this like alliance with the Polish lady down the hall because they were the only people against the Norwegians. And so I told Andrew, you know, this is like middle America, milquetoast. It's an anthropological study. So just roll with it. If you don't really get what people are talking about, we can talk about it later. Bars are cookies cut into squares. Hot dish is casserole. You know, you'll get the idea. It's going to be okay. And with my grandparents, they have both been Lutheran social workers. And, you know, really strong faith. The church was a big part of their lives. And so before Andrew got there, I had a couple of days with them. And I sat him down and I said, you know, I'm really excited for you to meet Andrew. He's really excited to meet you. But I want to tell you now, we're not going to get married, and we're not going to have babies. We love each other very much. We're planning on being together forever. It's a mutual decision, but you need to know this now before he gets here. And if you want to talk about it, that's fine. Let's talk about it. And weirdly, they were very cool with it. I mean, I was expecting to get grilled, and they kind of just rolled along. And so I was like, all right, well, let's just see how this goes. And so Andrew shows up, and, you know, we have like 3 days that we're planning to be there. And the very first day, my grandpa's a big talker, and he's like, I want to have a special talk with just you and Andrew, which sounds like the worst thing I've ever heard of. So, of course, the next 3 days were spent just avoiding that conversation. And, you know, we had our Jell-O salad in the cafeteria, and we went to the Scandinavian Music Jam at the Eagles Club, and had a great 3 days and successfully avoided the conversation. Until the last day, an hour before my Uncle Bob's to pick us up, to take us to the Twin Cities, my grandpa takes us aside and he says, okay, well, I reserved the game room and it's just going to be the three of us. Grandma's going to stay in the apartment. We're going to have a special little talk. And so he got us in there, sat us down, and he started telling us about his young friend, Mark. And Mark was the son of one of my grandfather's good friends. Mark was a young man who was really involved in his church, really strong faith, and my grandfather kind of became a mentor for Mark, especially in his faith and in the church. And one day, Mark asked my grandfather if they could speak privately, and Mark came out to my grandfather as the first person that he had ever come out to, which you know, for Mark was like this extremely vulnerable moment, especially because for Mark, he was speaking to my grandfather in relation to his faith and in relation to the church and what does his sexuality mean for his relationship with God. So very big conversation. And while obviously it was a major moment for Mark, it was kind of a big moment for my grandpa too, because I don't think he'd ever consciously known a gay man. Like he never really processed what that meant. And now this person he really loved is coming out to him in this very important life moment. So just to back up for a second, so this is me and my grandpa and Andrew sitting in a small room talking about this young gay man coming out to my grandfather. And my grandpa's talking for like 30 minutes straight. No questions, just talking about Mark coming out to him. And this is the special talk that he's been wanting to have with us for the last 3 days. And I've got no idea where he's going. I mean, what is he getting at? Why are we talking about Mark? And, you know, I'm just trying to figure it out. And it was like a lightning bolt. It suddenly hits me. Grandpa thinks Andrew's gay. That's got to be what this means. He thinks Andrew's gay. And when I told him that we loved each other, and we weren't going to get married and have babies, he thinks it's some weird contemporary relationship where Andrew's gay and I'm his beard, but Grandpa doesn't know what a beard is. So now I have to, I mean, I just start sweating instantly. And I look at Andrew and I can tell that he's also kind of like, what is going on in this conversation? And it's not a conversation. It's really just Grandpa talking. And so I'm trying to figure out, like, how do I tell my 80-year-old grandpa that my boyfriend's not gay? How do I do that in front of my boyfriend in a retirement home in Northfield, Minnesota? And I just got no clue. I have no idea what to do. So my grandpa's, you know, talking about Mark coming out and how hard it was. And finally, he seems like he's kind of wrapping up. And he's like, you know, I wanted to tell you about Mark because I wanted to tell you the same thing that I told Mark, which is that I came to realize in that conversation that God is love and love is holy. And whatever kind of love you have, that's the most important thing that you could ever have in your entire life. And I can see that you love each other. And whatever kind of relationship that you want to have, whether you want to be married, whether you don't want to be married, your grandmother and I support you, and we love you, and we just feel so blessed that you have love in your life. And that's it.
Our next speaker tonight is Crystal Hudak-Dooley. She was stationed by the Coast Guard in Juneau in 2010 and was stoked to have 3 years in Juneau. Pick the moss out from behind your ears and move on to somewhere warmer. Alas, life had other plans, and now Crystal has become a local. So local, in fact, when she goes to parties, she notices the socks everyone is wearing and uses, "I see you're a Kirkland family, too," as a conversation starter. She can also tell the difference between a tiramisu from Safeway and one from Costco. She has yet to wear sweatpants for grocery shopping, but don't worry, friends. There's still time.
The real reason I haven't worn sweatpants yet is probably because my spouse would disown me. So I'm waiting. It's coming. Friends, I'll be honest. I'm not sure what I was thinking volunteering to speak on grace. I really struggled on this topic. I can talk about incredibly important things in boring detail. My love of reality TV shows featuring pregnant high schoolers in tragic life circumstances, cats, and the fact that I live in a neighborhood so tight we have our own zombie apocalypse plan. I'm also really jazzed about watching hours of ice dancing in the Olympics coming up. But grace is one of those things that's hard to describe. But I think we all kind of know it when we see it. Most of the time, if I'm using the term grace, I'm using it in the word graceful. Like my lack of gracefulness, as I trip up the stairs or burn my mouth drinking scalding hot coffee. But I didn't want to let Amanda down, so I think I found a definition of the word. Grace is when you come home to a crockpot meal that looks awful and you pretend to love it anyways. Let me back up. I wasn't given a crockpot when I got married. A crying shame, I know. And I had no idea what I was missing until I told a friend about it, and he took my butt straight to the Kodiak Walmart and bought me a crock pot. Friends, life changing. It took James and I 3 years of marriage and a move to Juneau until I fully embraced the crockpot lifestyle. And if you know anyone getting married, for the love of all that's holy, buy them a crockpot. I don't mean that once in a while we eat chili, or maybe I make a bean dip. I mean that I am a diet and wool disciple of throw junk in a pot, go ski for 6 hours, and come back to something edible. We eat out of the crockpot 3 times a week. I feel like I should be ashamed of this fact. But no, I brag shamelessly at work. I'm like the office juicer who walks around with the weird colored concoctions to brag about how healthy they are. It's not about showing off my healthiness, but reveling in my laziness. However, two downsides, presentation and quantity. You have to accept your food will probably look like dinosaur barf and people decline dinner invites. My husband, James, describes it as the brown, mushy creature that was slung on Calvin's lunch tray by his disgruntled cafeteria lunch lady in the Calvin and Hobbes cartoons. It's always trying to eat Calvin. Sometimes it's cream asparagus soup for 2 weeks straight for lunch. Because James won't eat it, I don't want to waste food, and I'd figured I'd get the pain over at once instead of stretching it out into freezer meals. I had forgotten that I don't, in fact, like cream asparagus soup. And so I would dread eating my lunch, but I didn't want to skip lunch because that meant prolonging the pain a little bit longer. This week, I was going to impress my spouse with baked ziti. It was going flawlessly until I came home after it was cooking for 6 hours to find my baked ziti crunchy. I did what every responsible wife does and kicked my husband to go mooch food at the neighbor's house. I was able to salvage it by adding some more water, and guess what I'm eating for the next 3 weeks? There has only been one horrible epic disaster, and luckily James is at the Trooper Academy in Sitka for it. I attempted mushroom barley soup. The internet raved about it. I like barley, I like mushrooms, and I like soup. What could possibly go wrong, right? It was so awful the dog wouldn't eat it. And our dog eats tinfoil. Around Christmas, I gave an older neighbor 2 Tupperwares, one of pumpkin pudding and one of lentils. He had a heart attack the next day. If you know Tim, say hi to Tim for us. He claims it wasn't my cooking, but now we call them death lentils. James, he lives in fear of them coming home to that. So now, imagine you're James, JPD's newest and best-looking cop. I'm a little biased. It's Saturday, and you're coming off a 12-hour shift of Juneau 5-0, pulling cars over in the pouring rain, dealing with drunken morons, marauding garbage bears, and all other Juneau craziness. All you want to do is take off your 30 pounds of gear, steel-toed boots, enjoy a warm, home-cooked meal and beer in a state of domestic bliss. Since it's his coming home from long shift fantasy, he's probably hoping for a clean house, too. That would work great if your wife wasn't into cross-country skiing, trail running, sleeping late, and overall having a blast. So you come home to an empty house, and you text your wife because you know that she'll be home in a little bit, and you take a big sniff. Something's been cooking for a while, but what? What could it be? And your nose takes you to the crock pot, and you look in, and you think, holy smokes, I wish I stopped to breathe in. Hopefully it tastes good, or edible. Sometimes edible is what we settle on, and can be covered in cheese. James probably does some mental math on how much servings I'm going to stuff down his gullet. Sometimes half goes straight into the freezer, and then we get to be surprised what thawed dinosaur barf is. Once James hears crashing in the kitchen, I bet he puts his game face on. Imagine me coming in through our garage to kitchen door, giving him a quick kiss and asking how his day went. And that's the moment when grace kicks in. I tell him I've been slaving away all day in the crock pot. How did it come out? And James, he looks me in the eye, he smiles, and lies like a champ. He says, it looks great. How did you know I was looking forward to African peanut stew? I've heard men are supposed to ask for seconds the whole first year of married life to encourage cooking. I think this would encourage weight gain. If you see how good looking my husband is, ladies, let me tell you the secret. It may be grace that keeps him from telling me how much he hates the crock pot, but he definitely hasn't gotten fat. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Katie Rice. Katie Beadle Rice was born and raised in Juneau. After high school, she left for a brief stint to Spokane, Washington, Florence, Italy, and Anchorage before returning in 2004 with a husband she imported, thus proving her senior class at JDHS correct when they voted her most likely to stay in Juneau, though several of the members of the class of 98 are often spotted at Mudrooms events, so perhaps there's no monopoly on lifelong love of Juneau. As a child, her mother allowed her to pick out her own clothes, which led to horrid fashion choices, and a warning from Katie's great aunt Lorraine: if you let her pick out her own clothes now, you'll never be able to control her later. As predicted, Katie is completely uncontrollable and often stays up until 10 or even 11 reading novels and power watching Mad Men on Netflix.
So exactly a week ago tonight, I was in Disneyland, and I was walking with my father-in-law, Sid, in search of the Corndog Palace. And as we're walking, I'm telling him about how I'm going to get up, and I'm going to tell you all a story about Grace, and how I don't know which story to tell. And I have a story I really want to tell, but it would involve me using an expletive. And so I start telling it to Sid, and then I whisper the word out into the atmosphere of the Magic Kingdom. Sid gasps, my face turns red, and we both look up, and right in front of us is a Roman Catholic priest. Now, I work for the church. I teach Sunday school. And the man looked into my eyes like he was looking into my soul, and he raised his hand, and it might have been a wave, or it might have been the sign of the cross. I figured it was a benediction, so I need to tell you this story. The story of how I first swore. This story takes place when I am 20, and a key player in this story is my friend, Grace. Do some of you think that's funny that I didn't swear? Man, plan on a laugh for that one. All right, so, and my friend, Grace, is a key player in it. Now, some of you might know Grace because she lived here for several years between graduate schools, and wherever Grace goes, adventure abounds. Now, Grace and I met each other when we were studying abroad in Florence, Italy, and on the first couple weeks, we're touring around Germany with our whole group, and we're supposed to pick out roommates for the whole year, and Grace and I decide that we think we could live together, and Grace thinks I'm pretty cool because, you know, I'm from Alaska, but she has some hesitation. She says, Katie, do you ever do anything bad? And I didn't know what to say. And then she said, Katie, before this year is over, I want to hear you say, and she said it. She said the word, and I'm not going to say it, even though Amanda said she would bleep me, but I'll mouth it so y'all know, okay? She said, I want you to say. So, Grace and I continue on. And we go on lots of trips together, and we create a friendship, and I don't swear. And we decide that over Thanksgiving break, we are going to go to Ireland, because we've always wanted to go to Ireland. So we go to an internet cafe to look for fares cheap enough that we can afford, and we can't find anything within our budget. And then suddenly, I find it. It's like the holy grail of tickets. It's £10 from Heathrow Airport all the way to Ireland, and we look at it, and we see the little button that says non-refundable, non-transferable, even if you promise us your firstborn child, we will not change this ticket, and we click it. And then we realize that instead of GAL for Galway Airport, we've bought tickets to GLA for Scotland, Glasgow. So we go to Scotland, and while we're in Scotland, we run into a lovely man named Graham, who wears a kilt and speaks in an Irish brogue. And he also runs a bus company that takes backpackers on tours around Highlands of Scotland. So Grace and I decide, what the heck? Let's go do it. So we get on to his bus tour. And on the second day, Graham picks up a group of rowdy Australian backpackers. 2 hours after we pick them up, Graham finds a patch of snow. And he pulls over, and no sooner have we seen the snow than Grace and all the Australian backpackers are having a snowball fight. Now, I don't like to get cold, so I'm standing far enough back. Just a couple minutes before Graham is about to call us back onto the bus, Alec, an Australian sheep herder, tackles Grace. Now, I knew immediately something was wrong, because normally if you tackle Grace, she will throw you to the ground and rub your face in snow, but she didn't do anything. So I go over to her, and she's lying there in the snow, and she's looking up at me, and tears are coming down her cheeks, and she's trying to smile, and she says, "Katie, I don't want to be a wimp, but this really hurts." And Alec, looking justifiably mortified, comes over and says, "Oh, let me take a look at that for you. I have a lot of experience with my sheep." And so he undoes Grace's boot, and we watch in horror as her leg starts to swell 2, 3, 4 times its normal size. And I look at that ankle, and I think about the 3 train rides, the 2 planes, the 1 bus that separate us from Scotland Highlands all the way back to our home base in Florence where we have health care. And then I think about the fact that Grace and I both brought 50-pound backpacks with us to Scotland because we're both English majors and you can't travel with less than 5 books. And then I think about the fact that I've been hiding just a little bit behind Grace for these past 2 months because I'm Katie from Little Juneau, Alaska, and so I've been letting her chart our course and read all of the maps, and I've been letting her deal with the fresh Italian men and swear at them in Italian. And now it's up to me. So I look at that ankle, and I look at Alec, and I say, "Oh," because it really required that. And then I buck up, and I call the cheapest airlines in the world, and I make them change our tickets. And I haul Grace and myself all the way back over a 36-hour trek back to Italy. And I talk to all of the people and the different foreign languages, and I make the plane tickets and the train tickets. And I get back, and I tuck Grace into bed, and I go out to find us the best Italian takeout I can. And I think, wow, I left for Ireland a little girl who'd never sworn, and I have returned a woman. And I thought, you know what? No matter what life throws at me, I can handle it. And you know, I tell you, I felt graceful.
Our next speaker is Mila Cosgrove. Mila has lived in Juneau for 23 years and has lived in her current home for 13, a personal record. She feels that her 52 years on the planet have presented her with a variety of opportunities and challenges and hopes that she has met them with grace, grit, and a sense of humor, not necessarily in that order. She resides in the flats with her husband, Tom, her 2 teenage children, Coleman and Natalie, and her dog, Martin.
Good evening. That's kind of a hard story to follow, I have to say. I'm feeling a little intimidated at the moment. Thank you. My mother had a sense of adventure, a willingness to take risks, and an unbelievable belief in the universe would provide. She was charming, she was charismatic, and she was a total con artist. She had a heart of gold, and she would give anything she had to anyone in need, and she was unabashedly, unapologetically New Age. We're talking about psychic readings, aura cleansings, karmic balance, you name it. She also had a very loose relationship with fact and legal convention, frequently reinventing her reality as the need or her desires dictated. And as I was growing up, she had a series of very sketchy employment opportunities that included running an adult theater and after hours joint in Anchorage during the pipeline era, selling commercial real estate, managing a questionable commodities company, and giving psychic readings. All done to pay the rent and put food on the table. She was a single parent, after all, but also with the goal of get rich quick. Something that never happened. Never. So as she aged and her ambitions settled, she turned to government employment. And eventually landed a job at an agricultural inspection station on Route 62, halfway between Needles and Blythe on the California-Arizona border. It was the middle of nowhere. So Vidal Junction is a desert crossroads. At 70 miles an hour, you blow by it in the blink of an eye. It had a gas station, a greasy spoon diner, and an RV park, which is where my mother lived, and a fifth-wheel trailer that had found its final resting place. In 1994, shortly before she turned 57, my mother met her soulmate, the new short order cook at the Vidal Junction Cafe. They quickly formed a deep friendship. She fell madly and deeply in love. He moved into the trailer, and they got married. Sounds straightforward, right? Nothing about my mother is straightforward, not ever, to begin with. Although she was madly in love, Jeff was gay. A fact that he had told her from the time they met, right? He was also 20 years her junior. The marriage was a matter of convenience. She had medical issues. She had state-funded health insurance. It was a natural pairing. And while I generally was leery of my mother's new age sensibilities, I had to agree there was something there. Jeff was equal parts dreamer, con artist, and cowboy. He was irascible, irreverent, and just a touch new age. Except for the sexual orientation thing, they were perfect together. Before moving to the Junction, Jeff had lived in Palm Springs, and he described to me a successful and satisfying life that quickly became a burden as one after another of his friends developed AIDS. And he had spent the last several years nursing friends through illness to inevitable death. The Junction was his place of refuge. It was a retreat, a place to begin again. And short order cook was an undemanding profession after being a midwife to death. Shortly after they married, I noticed my mother began slurring her words. She sought medical treatment eventually and shortly thereafter was diagnosed with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, is a progressive degeneration of the body's motor neurons. Essentially, the brain loses its ability to initiate or control voluntary muscle movement. No two people have the same journey or experience except one. It is always, always fatal. My mother and Jeff met this new reality with equal parts horror and opportunity. So they quickly took out a mortgage and purchased a new truck, with the extra insurance in case one of them happened to die. They ran multiple minor scams involving medical reimbursements and jimmied electrical meters to stabilize their personal finances during a time when a lot of people would go medically bankrupt. My mother was convinced that the ALS had been triggered by taking two medications together, Lipitor and Mevacor, and she spent hours calling personal injury attorneys convinced that her death would result in a multi-million-dollar settlement. She talked incessantly about how they should spend the money, how we should spend the money after she died. It was an exciting time. So the average person diagnosed with ALS lives 2.5 years. My mother lived about two. Her difficulties began with swallowing. She would choke on her own saliva. She had a tracheotomy, which resulted in a loss of the ability to speak, and she could only take liquid nutrition. Shortly thereafter, she lost control of her major motor muscles. She couldn't walk. She was confined to a wheelchair and then eventually a hospital bed and required forced air and oxygen to assist with her breathing. Along the way, she suffered numerous indignities and losses of independence. There is nothing graceful about dying from ALS. It's a truly hideous disease. So during this time, my sisters and I all lived in Alaska. We couldn't really move down to the desert. We talked about it. It didn't work. We tried to get her to come to us, but she refused. And because of their remote location, there was no hospice or home care services available. And although we would go down every 6 to 8 weeks to help caretake a little bit, the reality was that the day-to-day caretaking fell on Jeff. So he had tried to leave illness and death behind, but it clearly was not done with him. Shortly after she turned 59, she was medevaced to L.A. The reality was Jeff was burnt out with the day-to-day caretaking. He couldn't do it at home anymore, and so we transferred her to a skilled nursing facility. It was a nice place, and we decided that she should probably stay. She, of course, pleaded to come home, as probably anybody would. And eventually, Jeff gave in. He offered to go home, get the house ready for her to return, and then come back the next day and pick her up. And she died that night at the facility. We said goodbye to her on the banks of the Colorado River. We shared food, companionship, and stories about her life, and there were a lot of stories to share. She was quite the character. And at sunset, I waded waist-deep into the Colorado River with a candlelit wreath, which I propelled into the main current. The water was warm, the colors were unbelievably beautiful, and I felt a sense of grace descend as I released the wreath into the current of the river, and I watched it float downstream. I have not been back to Vidal Junction since. Jeff disappeared from our lives as quickly as he had entered it. No notice, no forwarding address. We have no idea where he went or what's happened to him. An unlikely angel, he graced us with his presence during an imaginably difficult time. And I will always be grateful. Thank you.
You're listening to a recording of Mudrooms, Juno's live storytelling event on KTOO News Juno. These stories are recorded on January 14, 2014 at the Northern Light United Church. The theme for the evening was Grace. Curious? Visit www.mudrooms.org.
Pat McClear is our next speaker. 2013 was a great year for Pat McClear. One, the Supremes dumped DOMA, and she and Kim were able to swap out their civil union paperwork for a marriage certificate. Two, the Red Sox went from worst to first and brought the World Series trophy back to Beantown. Three, she went on a zip line and lived to talk about it. Four, she shared a stage with Tom Cosgrove telling coming out stories, and they both done good. How can 2014 top that? To be determined, Pat will turn 60, retire, and keep telling stories. Please welcome Pat, who will be sharing a story titled Grace, Like Pornography, Difficult to define, but you know it when you see it.
When Irish eyes are smiling, sure it's like a morn in spring. My father, Charlie McClea, died when he was 87 years old. We sang When Irish Eyes Are Smiling as a recessional hymn at his funeral mass. We had requested Tora Laura Laurel. The organist didn't have the music. I've been asked on more than one occasion how it is that I came to tell stories. And the answer is always the same. I learned seated at the kitchen table at the home that my parents shared for over 50 years. And that's where Charlie would hold court, with a brown long-necked bottle of Narragansett beer. We had our favorites, but the story most often requested was Brady's Wake. Charlie was born in 1912, my mother 1915. They were raised in an immigrant community, Downeasterners, Shanty Irish. And it wasn't uncommon for the dead to be waked in the front room. And that's what happened with Brady. Now, be assured that even though it was during Prohibition that the libations poured liberally, thanks to my maternal grandfather, Thomas Alphonse Traynor, the local beer baron. Now, those assembled at Brady's wake had decided that the neighbor who had been known to steal vegetables from Brady's garden should be taught a lesson. So they took Brady and they dumped him in the bathtub. And then some poor soul climbed in the casket, grabbed a pair of rosary beads, and closed his eyes. When the thief approached, he knelt down, blessed himself, and began his prayers for the dearly departed. And that's when the living dead sat bolt upright in the coffin and began to chastise the poor bastard of a mourner for liberating carrots out of Brady's garden. Now, at this time, my father is dancing about the kitchen, and he's got this brogue going on, and we're laughing, and tears are wetting our cheeks, and more than one of us have wet our pants. Nobody wants to leave the table for fear that you will miss a story. Now, at this point in time, you're probably ticking off a few stereotypes: Irish, Catholic, alcohol, and yes, we had a large family. My parents had 6 kids. About 20 years ago, my sister Paula, kid number 3, about 9 years my senior, was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease. Now, it took Paula a while to reconcile the fact that she was, in fact, going to die, and there was nothing she could do about it. So she decided she would do what she could. She chose the music and the readings for her funeral mass, the pink sweatsuit she wanted to be buried in. She asked a friend to do the eulogy, and she had her husband and their daughter dress in how they wanted to be at the funeral so she could be their fashion consultant. Paula's mass was held at the church we were all baptized in. St. John's is a big church, and it was packed. Her friend Carol got up and began the eulogy. Paula was like a butterfly. And then she proceeded to talk about a woman that she had only known for a little bit of time in some prayer group that they were in together. And by the time she was done, you would have thought Paula was up for canonization in sainthood. We all sat there rolling our eyes. We knew better. Of course, when it was all said and done, we ridiculed it, but not in front of my mother, because she cherished every word that was spoken. About 4 years later, my mother was gravely ill and ready to welcome death. And like my sister Paula, she made her wishes known. She wanted to die at home with my father by her side, holding her hand. It was a Wednesday in the middle of January, and my mother was trying to make her way across the living room, and she tripped and did a face plant. Charlie did not panic. He did not dial 911. He called hospice. And then that dear man sat on the floor with my mother, and he waited. That Saturday, we all gathered to hold vigil with Charlie, and it was late in the afternoon when he announced that it was time. So we all gathered around my mother's bed, where Charlie was seated holding her hand. He kissed his beloved. He told her it was okay. She could go now. And she did. I don't remember much about my mother's funeral mass. I just know that Charlie and I had our arms intertwined, each holding the other up. I received a phone call about 4 years later informing me that my father had suffered a major heart attack, and 2 weeks later he was dead. We went to the funeral parlor, and all the arrangements had been taken care of by my mother those years before. But the undertaker said, "Who are going to be the pallbearers?" And I said, "The 5 of us." And he said, "It's usually 6. And I said, "That 6th spot will remain open for our sister Paula." And then we were asked, did we want clergy at the burial site? And my sister Mary said, "No, thank you. We have Patty." It was a given that I would do the eulogy. My brother was driving us to the church, and I asked my siblings if I could share with them what I had prepared. No, they protested. We want to hear it with everyone else. But I persisted. Come on. Let me just, all right, I'll give you the beginning. Charlie was like a butterfly. My brother drove over the curb. We were laughing so hard, but nobody wet their pants. We were good. We got to the church. We escorted my father's body inside. My sister Kathy read the prayer of the faithful, which she had written. My sister Mary, a Eucharistic minister, dispensed communion, and I said the prayer at the gravesite. I miss my father. I miss my mother. And I miss my sister Paula. I remember them all with great love and affection. But when Irish eyes are smiling, sure and they'll steal your heart away.
Patricia Hull. Patricia's family moved to Juneau when she was 4 for what her mom says was promised as just 1 year, honey. Her folks retired south after 15 years, but Patricia stayed, joining the ranks of the thousands of single newcomers who claimed Juneau as their hometown. Patricia eventually left town for 15 years, earning a BA from Bennington College in Vermont and enjoying a 10-year career in philanthropy in Los Angeles and Southern California before returning in 1996. Currently, her vocation as a state worker supports her avocation as a performing artist. In early March at the Silver Bow, Patricia will world premiere SciCon's one-woman musical, Mother Jones in Heaven. She's donating all proceeds to the two groups she feels make Juneau, Juneau: Perseverance Theater and the Arts and Humanities Council. Please welcome to the stage Patricia Hull.
I moved to Southern California to be close to my sister and her family, and was really happy when I found a place just a mile and a half away from her. The downside was the job I found was 35 miles away to the north, which was a very long commute of 70 miles every day. It was a lot of NPR. But I can't really complain because everybody in my office commuted long distances. My boss commuted 57 miles one way. And the only person who didn't commute was Maxine, our receptionist, who had lived in the same house in Torrance for 40 years. Maxine hated me. She disliked pretty much everything and everybody, but I was particularly just a little too perky for her. And no matter how hard I tried, it just made it even worse. So I'd say, you know, good morning, Maxine.
What's good about it?
And I decided I would just give her wide berth. Well, in 1995, Southern California experienced an enormous rainstorm. We were all at work when this storm just moved in out of nowhere. And California is not built for rain. I mean, they have gutters and stuff, but they don't get flushed out very often. And so they fill up with palm fronds and trash and kids' toys. And then when they do need to be used, they're clogged. So the rain was pouring down. We've had rain, like biblical rain today. This was rain you couldn't even see through. And the freeways became lakes because all of the low places just would accumulate the water. And by the time I got on the freeway for my 35-mile commute home, it was just stop and go, and cars were stalling out in the middle of the freeway, and people were just abandoning their cars. They weren't even putting up the hoods, and so other people were bashing into the ends of them, and it was just a total mess. I finally said, okay, I got to get off the freeway. I got to find a motel. I got to hunker down. And by the time I found an off-ramp that wasn't clogged with stalled cars, I was so happy, but it was only like 3 miles from the office, and 3 hours later, I pulled off and I was in this total no man's land. I mean, it wasn't like businesses or houses or anything. It was industrial parks and all these gated complexes, and then the lights went out, and now I'm really kind of getting scared. I don't know where I am. My gas gauge is low. I've been driving forever, and finally I see this light, and I get near it. It's a gas station. I get out, and I'm gassing up my car, and I got my umbrella over me, and I'm hunkered down, and I got the gas thing in, and all of a sudden I realize I'm not alone. I hear voices, and I look up, and there's five young men approaching me rather quickly. And now, living in California, I had developed a kind of fear level that I had never known before, because people did have ill intent in a lot of ways, like the guy that followed me out of the movie theater, and thank God I got into my car before he grabbed the handle and I pushed the little lock thing, and things like that had happened to me. So I look up and see these five young men coming right at me, all dressed the same, and my heart stopped and my breathing stopped. And one of them is shouting at me, he's saying, "Carjack!" And I just thought, okay, you can have it. I mean, it's, you know, take the Corolla, you know. And then another one is pointing to my trunk, and I'm thinking, what? I'm envisioning myself stuffed into the trunk, you know. And I'm like this. And then they get close enough to me, and I realize that, you know, I can see their faces and their eyes, and they do not mean me any ill intent at all. And one of them says to me, "You have a car, Jack?" Yes, I said, I so do. Okay, 5 minutes later, they're changing their tire and everything is fine, and they tell me that they're five brothers and they're going to see their mother who's in the hospital, and you know, all of that fear adrenaline that I had pumping through my veins was suddenly, I was elated, I was giddy, I was happy, and I knew exactly what I had to do. In my wallet, I had the phone numbers, all the home phone numbers of all my coworkers. Our company had given us that in case of emergency, and I figured this qualified. So I knew Maxine lived close to the office, and I called her, and she picked up on the first ring, and she could hear the rain, and she could tell I was outside, and I didn't really have to say much. She pretty much put it together. "Where are you?" And I told her. She gave me directions to her house, and we drank tea, and we waited, because she thought I had been her daughter when I first called. She was waiting for her daughter to call. It was there that Maxine explained to me that she had lived in that house. She and her husband had been an aerospace engineer for 40 years, and he got Alzheimer's. And she had tried to care for him at home and eventually had to put him in a nursing home. And she was on the verge of declaring bankruptcy when she got the office job where I knew her. So at 60, she had reentered the workforce after having been a housewife for many, many years. And after that night, something clicked and shifted between us. There was a new level of trust. And I remember it vividly when we actually came to a meeting of the minds. She was wearing this blue dress, blue and green dress, and it made her blue eyes just shine. And she looked so beautiful in it. And you have to understand, Maxine looked like the Maxine of the comic Maxine. You know what I mean? She usually looked like that. She was very, very cranky. And this day, she was just alive with beauty. And I said, "Maxine, that dress, you look so beautiful." And in true Maxine fashion, she said, "This old thing, I've had it for 20 years. And I got this rip under the arm I can't get out. And I've had to replace the hem. And it's got a stain right there." And she just completely tore the dress apart. And then after a little bit, I could see this expression on her face like she was gone. How did I get here? What got me off on this tangent about the damn dress? And then she looked at me, and I looked at her, and I said, "Maxine, you're welcome." And, you know, it hit her funny bone, and she just put her head back, and it was the first time I made Maxine laugh. Thank you.
Our final speaker this evening is Grace Elliott. Grace wandered into Juneau one spring day in 1980 on a 10-day vacation from which she never returned. Born and raised on Chicago's South Side, she has shared her love of the blues for over two decades on public radio, where she's known variously as Sister Grace and the Blues Goddess. She has told stories for pleasure and professionally for many years, working with generations of Juno's children. Central to her present life is the practice and teaching of Kundalini yoga and meditation. She has had half a century to meditate on tonight's theme. Here's Grace.
All that is true. I feel someone should be up here adjusting my mic for me. All that is true, and I think Alita Buss was one of my storytelling kids back in the day at Ock Bay School, maybe? I told stories for many years, and then one day I stopped. And so I'm here. I'm Grace. That's enough. I don't need to tell you a story. I really am not here to tell you a story tonight. I thought about this a lot. I've wept about it a little. And I just can't fake it on this one, I've discovered. I really did stop telling stories. I told stories for 15 years. I loved it dearly. It was one of the most beautiful jobs I ever had. I told stories because they could lift the spirit and they could entertain as we were tonight. Let's just have a hand for Mudrooms. Storytelling is alive and well in Juno. I went to the very first one, and this is the second one I've been to, because I was like, oh, great, somebody else is doing it. I don't have to do this anymore, and I quit telling stories. And I wasn't really sure why, because I loved it so much. And I really believe in the worth of telling stories, but it was because I needed to go deep into an understanding of grace, really. My own self, my own being. What is grace? And I also learned the downside of stories for human beings. So I'm not really going to tell you a story, but I'll tell you a tiny little vignette. Anybody here at the Taj Mahal concert last May? Yeah. Well, let's get an amen for that. It was beautiful. It was like my fantasy. It was the best thing in the world for me to be at this Taj Mahal concert because I got to do the dance floor feng shui. Because I had been at his concert at Centennial Hall in 1980, and to my deep horror, nobody moved. There were about 20 of us dancing furiously by the stage, and everybody else was acting like good Junoites, having a really great time, not doing anything. So I thought, this time that's not going to happen. So briefly, I will say my dance floor feng shui worked out really well, and everybody was on the dance floor from before the band even got on stage, and they stayed on the dance floor all night, and people were shouting and singing and dancing. It was beautiful. The music was so exciting, and it was so joyful, and there were 1,200 happy Junoites there, and I was happy because my dance floor feng shui really worked well, and I loved Taj Mahal, and I had the grace to be able to be in the green room afterwards. And I was just trying to scurry around and help clean up and stuff. But he is a great storyteller himself. And we ended up talking story. And while I was at it, I said, you know, I noticed something. At the end of the concert, you know, the last song, everybody's screaming and yelling, and the band went off, and pounding was happening, screaming, yelling, and out they came for the encore, and they did something really unusual. I mean, of course you want to bring it up high and you want to bring it down a notch for the encore, right? But they brought it way down here, way, way down here. It was soft, and it was gentle, and it was sweet. It was a lullaby, and it was hypnotic, and people left just kind of sweetly, 1,200 people just floating out the door. And I asked him about that. I said, Taj, that is really beautiful. But I didn't expect that. And he said, yeah, you know, a lot of guys, they want to like lead the people way up there, you know. He said, I just want to give the people their breath back. And I thought that was such a beautiful thing. And we've had such amazing stories tonight. I don't know about you, but I cried a little bit. I certainly laughed a lot. And so with my few minutes left here, what I would like to do is give the people their breath back. And what that has to do with grace is this. Here's something I noticed about the downside of stories with people. We're designed so beautifully. We're really remarkable creatures of grace and beauty. We have a vast, infinite connection with each other, with every living thing out there, maybe things that aren't living too. I don't know how you feel about rocks, but I love them. But we do this thing. We have a sensation. Maybe the breeze blows across our cheek. Get that electrical sensation when someone you're attracted to walks through the room. And it's beautiful. It's our design. And if we could just stay in the flow of sensation and experience it and bring all those sensations sort of equal to each other in our awareness, what a beautiful thing that would be. But that's not what we do. We have a sensation. Then we label it pain. Then we wrap a story around that. And then every time that sensation comes by, again, we tell the story again. And then we start these deep synaptic grooves in our brain. And we keep telling that story anytime we have that sensation or anything that feels like that sensation, and pretty soon we're telling a really outdated story and we've made ourselves very small. But we can expand ourselves out again. And if there's anything divine in you, it is your breath. That's where the grace is. So let us conspire. Let us breathe together in this way. Close your eyes. And inhale deeply through your nose. And as you exhale, imagine you're exhaling out your heart. And inhale again deeply. And exhale, and let that exhale from your heart fill this whole room, everyone it contains, everyone they love. And inhale and tell yourself this. I am the grace of God. Thank you.
This is KTOO News Juno 104.3 FM. The stories you just heard were recorded on January 14th, 2014. The theme for the evening was Grace. Visit mudrooms.org to tell your story. Audio production by Rich Moniak.